This episode is brought to you by our incredible community of listener supporters on Patreon. Our Patreon offers listeners exclusive archival content, extended episodes, and access to community conversations diving deeper with past guests. Your monthly pledge ensures that For the Wild has the funding to keep producing informative, thoughtful, and rooted conversations and programming. All funding supports our small team of creatives, podcast production, and special For the Wild projects like our zines and slow study courses. To support us on Patreon, please visit patreon.com/forthewild. Or if you would rather make a one-time donation or recurring donation outside of Patreon, please visit forthewild.world/donate. Hey, For the Wild community, Ayana here, and I wanted to share a few updates before we converse with Jeremy Lent. First, if you're in the LA area, join Jade Begay and myself for a Dear Earth event on April 21st. We're going to be in dialogue around protecting public lands, decolonization, justice from Alaska to the Gulf, and the Tongass National Forest Campaign. We'll also be premiering When Old Growth Ends in Los Angeles. Go to ConsciousCityGuide.com for more info. Also, our online education learning lab is launching May 1st. If you want to be a part of the beta group, head over to our website at forthewild.world and also sign up for our newsletter to receive a special code. All right, now onto the show.
The silence is broken by somebody crying, trying to be heard, never a word. Always the attitude, sort of your own, always alone. Wishing for something the world is denying. Out in the wilderness, somebody's crying. Somebody wishing for something to happen, wishing to tell, wishing to help. Someone was listening, someone who cared. Never despair, someone to lean on and someone to trust. Who needs your assistance and finds your disgust?
Hello and welcome to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. Today we will be speaking with Jeremy Lent. Jeremy is an author whose writings investigate the patterns of thought that have led our civilization to its current crises of sustainability. His book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, published last year, explores the ways humans have made meaning from the cosmos, from hunter-gatherer times to the present day. He is a founder of the nonprofit Leology Institute, dedicated to fostering an integrated worldview that could enable humanity to thrive sustainably on the Earth. The new book he is currently working on is The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe. Well, welcome, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you, Ayana. I'm so glad to be talking with you today.
So I want to start off with a very big and layered question, which is, what engendered the rise of capitalism and enabled dominant culture to rot such unrelenting ecocide and genocide across the planet? And I know that this can bring in different answers depending on who you are. For instance, a friend and inspiration of mine, Lila June, daughter of Dene, Cheyenne, and European lineages, and a student of global cycles of violence and the destruction of cyclical relationships between human beings and nature, and then as well as the celebrated book Caliban and the Witch by Silvia Federici, they speak about how capitalism arose as an outgrowth to the trauma or madness of the genocidal witch hunts of European women. There also exists a breadth of literature tying the origins of capitalism to the Neolithic Revolution and the advent of social hierarchy, private property, and the accumulation of excess. So, Jeremy, you contend that the seeds of capitalism were planted very early in human development, and you've come to describe what underlies the foundation of Western thought as the patterning instinct. So would you start us off by introducing the concept of the patterning instinct and explain how it helps us understand the core of our current crises?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Ayana. And definitely raised some big, big questions there. And I do think it's a good place to begin just by looking at this patterning instinct itself, which is this instinct that we humans have to pattern meaning into the world. And it's something, it's an instinct we share with other mammals, but we humans have it to a far greater degree. And it's the instinct that allows a little infant, when she's born, to learn language. For example, nobody tells her, hey, you know, you should listen to these words and make sense of them. But her patterning instinct patterns meaning into all the sounds and movements she feels around her until she begins to learn the language of her culture. And way back when modern humans first evolved and we started to develop language ourselves, this patterning instinct kind of drove us to look at the universe around, the stars and all the stuff happening in nature around, and to try to pattern some sense of meaning into it all. And that's what led to early myths. And every culture we've ever known throughout history has always needed to make some kind of meaning, pattern meaning into the world around us. And what's so important about that is that the patterns of meaning that different cultures have created from time immemorial have led to what their values are, and ultimately led to what they've done and has shaped history and taken us to the present day.
I'm wondering if you could touch on the significant phase transitions that led Western thought to where it is now, the emergence of the prefrontal cortex, the Neolithic revolution, the scientific revolution, and then the most recent global corporate takeover.
Yes, right, exactly. And it is very much this kind of layering, just as you're touching on. I'll give just really sort of high-level sense of how those layers happened, and then maybe we can sort of go deeper into whichever ones, you know, seem the most sort of the most important to look at. But so we first evolved this development of this prefrontal cortex, which is more involved in humans than any other mammals again. And that's really where the patterning instinct is kind of mediated, as they say, in neuroscientists say, in our brain. That's what led to language, which was probably the first major step in us becoming who we are today. Really, we then spend 95% of our history, our ancestors, as nomadic hunter-gatherers. And in each different sort of layer of meaning we put in the world, we created what I call root metaphors. And those metaphors essentially like where all the different ways in which we sort of make sense, the kind of ramifications come from. So the hunter-gatherers of our ancestors really saw nature as like a giving parent. They just saw the universe as sort of like a big mother and father, and all the creatures around them were spirits, like part of the same family. And that all changed very, very drastically with the rise of agriculture, which began about 12,000 years ago. And it wasn't even so much the agriculture itself, but what they call sedentism, like humans settling in one place, that led to things like rise in hierarchy and possessions and in the very notion of wealth and inequality. And that's also most likely, I'm pretty much convinced, certainly where the patriarchy began, at the same place. So that was maybe the single biggest step in all of human history, that emergence of agriculture. And then I see other layers. I see from that, like big civilizations arose all around the world, but there was something very particular that happened about 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece that led to a more dualistic way of looking at things, which I see as a kind of seeds of everything that's happened in European culture and now global culture since then. And I'll just kind of jump forward and say that it was really the next big step that I see was the scientific revolution that happened in Europe in the 17th century. I think that is where we need to take a really close look, because some of the ideas that came from that, looking at like nature as a machine and the idea of conquering nature, really sowed the foundations for modern capitalism, which in itself we see kind of evolving in its thoughts in the 18th and 19th century, but then takes this huge leap in modern American history, starting about 100 years ago, the beginning of the 20th century. We see this whole kind of another transition shift to this sort of global corporate destruction of the natural world that we see around us happening right now.
You detail that all cultures are underpinned by root metaphors that shape how people view and act in the world. While Western civilization's root metaphor became the conquest of nature, traditional Eastern cultures and indigenous cultures worldwide were framed upon more harmonious root metaphors. So could you elaborate on how root metaphors have come to function so strongly in human societies, and how all root metaphors are inevitably inconclusive, given the vast complexity of the universe and the limitations of our human patterning?
A way to get the sense of how every metaphor sort of includes some things and leaves other things out is just to think about what a pattern is in itself. Like when we apply our patterning instinct to anything, what we basically do with a pattern, like think of how we look at constellations in the night sky or whatever, we include some points, some sort of data points in that pattern, and then we exclude others. And that's what a pattern is. It's including some things, making them more relevant, and then excluding others. We then begin to not even notice they're there because we're so focused on what our patterns show us. And that's what we do basically anytime we sort of use these core metaphors to make sense of the world. So, for example, when we went into agriculture, that was this very hierarchical society then that people started to live in. And so then when they made sense of the universe and they sort of created this kind of root metaphor of the universe, they sort of modeled their own lives on that, and they started to see the universe as a hierarchy of the gods. So everything became hierarchical, and you had to do things like sacrifice to these gods, just the same way that they might have had to pay taxes to the chief who had control over them. And so those are the sort of things that happen. So every time you have a root metaphor, it begins to like have logical connections and steps which affect your behavior. Probably this most important metaphor that happened is that we look at the contrast between Western and traditional thought is when the ancient Greeks saw the universe as being this kind of split universe of some sort of perfect dimension out there in the heavens that was unchanging, and a world down here, the physical world, that was polluted and was always changing and you couldn't trust. And they saw humans as being split too. They saw like this kind of a soul that was eternal, that was our divinity, that connected us with the perfection of the universe, and our bodies, which were also polluted, and the soul was almost like entombed in the body. And that was so different from any other way in which cultures viewed the humans and nature up until then. So, for example, in traditional China, you see a very different way of making sense of the world developing. They developed this root metaphor that was more like a harmonic web of life. So you will know, like if you're walking in the forest and you see a web, you know that just the slightest drop of water or a leaf just touching it will create these reverberations throughout the entire web. And the Chinese saw life itself like that. They saw the whole universe and the heavens, earth, and humans as being connected like that. So if you see the universe like that, then it means that you need to be incredibly reverent and careful about every step you take, because you know it's going to have these reverberations all around you. Whereas if you see basically nature as being kind of separate from humanity and the world as not being sacred because sacredness is up there in the heavens, then you have a very different view to how you treat the natural world. And that's the root metaphor that led to the Western way of thinking.
Thinking about human history can be such a mind warp. You know, Europe wasn't always so dominant and violent. There was a time before the witch hunts that I like to believe in, at least. And it leads me to think back to the celebrated book, The Chalice and the Blade by Rian Eisler, which traces back to incursions of violence, you know, and diminutive nomadic tribes bringing chaotic transformation to the egalitarian, peaceful, life-giving communities of the Mediterranean, some which lasted into the Bronze Age. So how and when do you think violence and domination became so pervasive in the once diverse earth-based cultures of Europe?
I see kind of two phases to this. I do think that everywhere that agriculture developed, you do see a shift towards some form of a patriarchy. There are some exceptions to that. And just like Rianne talked about in her book, the very earliest cultures in agrarian cultures were more matriarchal than they became. But I do think that we have to recognize that almost everywhere where people settled and the agricultural civilizations developed, they were pretty patriarchal and they were hierarchical. And there was some level of violence. But it went to a whole other level with exactly what Rianne traces. Like, there was this group of basically marauders. They were known as the Proto-Indo-Europeans. And these were people who lived about probably 6,000-7,000 years ago. And it's most likely they were north of the Caspian Sea. And they were the first people to learn how to basically tame horses. And sort of all of a sudden, this whole new like sort of military technology developed where they were able to sort of attack people using their horses. And they were also the first pastoralists. They began to sort of, you know, grow these massive sort of herds of early cows, and their whole culture was based on this kind of pastoral set of values. And this was a very, very like extreme sort of patriarchal dualistic view of looking at things. Like, they were very focused on brothers guarding their herds together, because if your wealth is all in these herds and other people attack your herd, and you can lose everything overnight. So the sort of warrior mentality got to be really strong. And what's so fascinating is that they're called Proto-Indo-Europeans because nobody knows exactly for certain where they were, but you can trace languages from all different European languages and even Indian languages like Sanskrit. You can trace back to this group of people, which is why we kind of figure we're pretty sure as to where they were and when they were. And their languages themselves were very kind of dualistic. So an example I love to look at is they've got this kind of this word that is the root word for what we now use as words like right, which is also the word for rex or like regal, which is also the word for like Raj you see in India. And there's this notion that sort of might is right, you know, that your sort of right hand is your strong hand. And there was this whole sort of right-left dualism that they developed. And when they came to Europe, they really did change the whole cultural quality of European communities at that time. They basically, they conquered everywhere they went because they had these horse technologies. They essentially destroyed the cultures that were there. And even though genetically the people stayed the same group of people, the culture that took over and the language that took over came from these kind of violent, patriarchal, dualistic group of people. And that's where I think we see the modern worldview really emerging from.
The world's full of people and they're all related to me. I've got several million relatives in every country. We are all descendants and extended family, all the plants and the animals and all humanity. I'm a brother to the birds and a cousin to the trees. I'm an uncle to the oceans and the fishes in the seas. Since we're all related, I have got no enemies, from the greedy politicians to the sea anemones. Every piece of this world is a part of the whole.
The concept of Weetago keeps popping up in my head, and I've spoken about Weetago on the show before, but to refresh the audience's memory, the Weetago is this cannibalistic spirit within mythologies of indigenous nations Algonquin, Ojibwe, etc., of Northeast North America, that, quote, delude their host into believing that cannibalizing the life force of others is a logical and morally upright way to live, end quote. It's also, quote, raising the self-serving ego to supremacy, end quote. So many now consider that Weetago as a mind virus in our collective psychology. And I find the word virus so fitting for the patterning of dominant culture. So I'm wondering, does the concept of Weetago resonate with your work?
It does, you know, it really does. And we could probably go all the way back to even before humans actually evolved as modern humans to look at this kind of drive towards the sort of male violence, because essentially it's almost always coming from the male gender, this sort of drive for like violent domination. And this is something I think is so important, is that, you know, oftentimes we're told that humans themselves are, you know, selfish or violent, and that's just the way it is. And so we need society to kind of control these drives, et cetera. But, you know, what I find so interesting is that what makes humans unique and different from other primates is that, in fact, other primates are more structured along these lines, with the exception of the bonobos, which are really interesting in themselves. But other primates are more structured along these lines of this kind of alpha male who really tries to dominate. But when humans first emerged as humans in these hunter-gatherer bands, even millions of years ago, like pre-humans, and it was our ability to be together, to actually connect up with each other in community, that really made us unique. And it was the thing that values and ideas like compassion and empathy and really what's known as shared intentionality, working together, acting together as a group, that really made us who we are as humans. And I think when we look at Weetago as this concept, it's almost like this really ancient primeval drive that is there, as I said, mostly in males to dominate and conquer and to destroy that harmony that's there. Whereas what actually really makes us human is this alternative, this opposite kind of drive to really be together in community, in connection with nature and with others. And that's how hunter-gatherer bands, 95% of human history, they were amazingly egalitarian. Very much sort of avoided violence as a kind of last resort in just the most extreme situations. So I think there's a lot to learn from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had a few people on the show talk about Weetago, Al Nurlata, Ariel Durange, and it really seems like this sickness that has taken over. And what is the cure for Weetago is the big question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I recently was listening to your interviews with Derek Jensen on Deep Green Resistance Radio recently, and I want to bring up what you two were discussing in regards to how corporate capitalism absorbs cultural shifts and co-opts everything. You and Derek spoke about how slavery didn't disappear, but was turned into the Jim Crow laws, which was then transformed into the prison industrial complex, as well as how the environmental movement was co-opted from being a movement for the protection of wild land and wild beings into one that protects business as usual and the survival of human civilization under the blanket of, quote, green sustainability. So I'd love to hear anything you'd like to add along this train of thought, and perhaps how and why corporate capitalism has the resiliency to absorb such a diversity of compelling and meaningful shifts in culture.
I just think this is one of the most important things to really get an understanding of. And, you know, where I'd like to begin when looking at this theme is this kind of realization that when we look at social and cultural norms over the last century or even the last few centuries, and even though it feels right now in this current administration like everything has just gone to hell, the reality is that over time, our social cultural norms have really progressed. We've made amazing advances. So, you know, just as we're saying, like slavery was considered the norm a couple hundred years ago, even though it's still around in certain forms, it's everyone kind of recognizes it's illegal. But even things like 100 years ago, it's hard to believe, but women didn't even have a vote in democracies around the world. And now, of course, you know, it's just unthinkable. And it goes on and on like that. Like just in recent times, the acceptance of same-sex marriage has gone from being another thing that was unthinkable to being pretty much widely accepted in most advanced societies. So all of these things feel like positive. But what's so fascinating, and I think really important to look at, is that none of those social changes actually changes this power, this stranglehold that global corporate capitalism has over our society. So think of sort of right and left in these kind of social battles or whatever over the generations. But because I think the thing to understand is that the whole corporate system, corporate America, has no value other than increasing shareholder value for its shareholders, basically monetizing the natural world and monetizing human behavior and turning it into profits for its shareholders. And because it has no other value, it's really like a sociopath. So like a sociopath, in order to do what he wants to do, doesn't actually have like, you know, oh, I'm going to do this is right and that's wrong. He'll take anything and manipulate it to his own end in order to accomplish whatever he wants, even if it involves killing people or whatever, as long as he can get away with it. He has no values other than whatever it is that drives him. And similarly, we see that with corporate America. So if women get more empowered in a society, corporate America is fine with that as long as it can turn it into more ways to make money, you know. And similarly, with any kind of social change that happens, in corporate America, it's all about turning everything into money making. And that's what's so terrifying, is that what we have to do is take the kind of power, the kind of grassroots empowerment that we've seen in things like the hashtag MeToo movement right now, which I think is fabulously transforming norms, even as we speak. But we need to take that and apply that to the corporate world. We somehow have to get people to recognize that the system that has now taken total dominance of the world, that drives even like countries' governments are sort of subservient to this kind of corporate power. And that's what has to change if we are going to actually get the world to move to some place that is sustainable, that can allow for human flourishing. And so we can look deeper at that. But I think that's the important thing to recognize, is that there are no values in corporate America other than maximizing shareholder value. And that's the thing that we have to fight against. We have to get people to be aware of.
I couldn't agree more. And I see how this desire for the bottom line, the financial bottom line, and this never-ending growth infiltrates all areas of this dominant Western culture, even when it's things that seem to be socially beneficial, like the nonprofit industrial complex, the restoration industrial complex. It seeps into our psyche so that even when we're trying to do, quote, good things, it has made its way, this Weetago, this virus has made its way into all these sectors of our lives.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so we can almost see Weetago as being this kind of core virus, this cognitive virus at the core of the capitalist notion of that maximizing shareholder value is this kind of end in itself. Something I find so ironic, you know, you read a lot nowadays, often some of the great sort of scientists and technological thinkers of the time talk about the risk of artificial intelligence taking over, you know, the risk of AI, and this is an existential risk for humanity. And oftentimes they'll talk about this idea that to explain why it's such a risk, they say, well, you know, supposing you could develop this artificial intelligence and tell it that what you're meant to do is just make paper clips. You know, it uses all this intelligence to turn the whole of the earth and all of human activity into one gigantic paperclip manufacturing facility. And, you know, in the end, it'll just kill every human just so it can make more paperclips from their resources. And that's the danger. And what they're missing is we've created that artificial intelligence already a few hundred years ago when we started this notion of the legal corporation. If you think of it, optimizing shareholder value is really nothing other than a gigantic paperclip manufacturing facility. It's this power. Ultimately, this kind of cognitive virus, this way to go virus, is like looking at the whole of the natural world as a resource for just continuing to increase shareholder value for profits. And that's the only thing that it's about. If we recognize that, then what's logical is we have to get to the root of that. We have to actually try to push for things that are barely even talked about nowadays and that actually control that at its root. We have to do things like push for changing the laws of corporations, make it illegal, essentially, for a corporation to just maximize shareholder value unless they're also doing what's called a triple bottom line, you know, looking at optimizing for the planet and the community. And, you know, corporations should have to basically get their charters renewed every 5 or 10 years. And there should be like a group of citizens who make the judgment as to whether they're really optimizing for all three of those things. Like, that's the kind of thing that can actually shift. But, you know, we barely even see talk about those kind of ideas because, you know, partly because, of course, the same corporations also control the media. So they control what people hear, which is a part of the problem.
Absolutely. It's definitely a part of the problem. The news that we actually hear, the co-optation of our information, whether that's through the television or through social media, it has been controlled. And it makes sense for the powers that be to control us through those means. The other thing I wanted to, or what's been kind of brewing in my head, is that there seems to be certain fixtures that continue to severely numb us into the destructive patterning of modern times. Like money, you know, what we've been talking about and how it became synonymous with value, or the emergence of the clock, which was essential for us to begin to place monetary values on our labor. And then money is detrimental on so many levels because it binds us to this linearity and a narrow perception of time, robbing us of a true appreciation for the value in our work and our life itself. And then we're constantly stuck in the past or the future without a genuine appreciation for either. And now that we have technology narrowing us even further, you know, talking about social media and the internet and something like that. And so we have this money, time, and technology that all remind us of the feedback loops between culture, livelihood, and genetics that you write about in The Patterning Instinct.
Yeah.
So I just, on a more basic level, you describe such feedback loops, and I want to quote you from the book. Quote, because cooking frees up more energy from food for our bodies to digest, new generations relied increasingly on cooked food, leading eventually to physiological changes that caused their descendants to depend on cooking in much of the same way spiders depend on their webs. Much later in history, when cattle were first domesticated, a few lucky people had genes that allowed them to drink milk as adults, known as lactose tolerance. With the extra nutrition available to them, they flourished, leaving more offspring, until their genes spread through virtually the entire population of Europe, end quote. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on money, fixation on linear time, or technology altering the genetic code of humanity.
Yes. What we see, like you say, in these kind of feedback loops, is that when a new idea takes hold, that idea can then affect who's successful and who's unsuccessful. And if the people who are successful in that community base their success on that idea becomes dominant. Before you know it, it's taken over. And so, you know, you see that when agriculture first emerged and the more aggressive societies would go conquer the others and sort of and dominate them. But you see that in the West so much in this kind of notion of the mechanization of nature. And to your point, here's the feedback loop. Like when people see nature as something that doesn't have any intrinsic sanctity and just use it for whatever resource you can, if you have a society that rewards that by allowing you to sell more and make more, then you become the most successful. And then people want to follow what you're doing. And so before you know it, those who are still looking at some of the deeper intrinsic sacredness of nature become sort of viewed as failures. And that's the way that Western European thinking developed into this whole sort of notion of global success. And money plays a part in that, in the sense that as a means of exchange, even tens of thousands of years ago, people were using sort of things like beads or anything as a way of kind of sharing things together and, you know, actually trading with each other. But where money got to be so extreme is when it actually got to be transformed just in the last 100 or so years as something completely separate from any physical, tangible quality. So it became this concept that Greg created through debt. And it's another of these feedback loops, in that once you create money out of debt, you need to basically keep growing your economy in order to pay back the debt. So it's like this thing that continues to move at a faster and faster growth rate that's never ending. And that's where it's not just that we have these corporations with their corporate roles that are looking to just sort of maximize shareholder value by essentially monetizing the earth, but the very economy needs this growth in, you know, what they call gross domestic product, which essentially just is the measurement of how quickly they're turning the earth into the monetized economy. It has to grow at a faster and faster rate just to stand still, just in order to pay back the debt. And then, of course, companies get valued as a multiple of the amount of earnings they are showing each year. So they have to keep growing in order to keep their shareholder value. So the whole thing is this positive feedback loop where one thing keeps adding to the rate of the other. So we get faster and faster growth rates from bigger and bigger global economy, to the point that now it's considered, you know, the bankers and equity analysts and people out there are figuring out, I think we're going to be looking at a tripling of this rate of consumption of the earth by the middle of this century. So in just a few decades, we're looking at how much we're destroying the earth right now, how much we're losing the rainforests, how much we're increasing global climate breakdown, et cetera. We're looking at triple that by mid-century. So, you know, where is this going to go, I think, is the key question. And what can we do about it? Those of us who are looking at this and are just horrified by where we see things heading.
It is absolutely horrifying where things are heading. Just thinking about the Tongass National Forest with less than 2 or 1% even of old growth forest left globally, and our taxpayer dollars are being used to cut the remaining old growth in this country. It's absolutely horrifying and disgusting. And I've actually heard you reference how the concept of ecosystem services, which is part of this definition, this language that allows us as a civilization to continue these horrifying actions, and how this concept it's worrisome. And I really like if you could speak on the dangers of monetizing nature from the framework of cultural evolution.
I think that's so important that even, you know, people in the environmental movement, or at least some of them who look at what's going on, get this notion, well, okay, we see this runaway power of this corporate capitalist mentality. Well, if we need to talk to these people on their terms. So they come up with this notion of ecosystem services, which is essentially to say, look, don't destroy all of nature, because look at the value it does for us. So, you know, these wetlands here, you know, we can value them based on this and that, and look at the hundreds of millions of dollars they're worth, or this coral reef, you know, that's off the shore here in this resort area. Look how valuable that is. But of course, that can instantly be turned around because somebody else can come along then and say, okay, so this coral reef, let's say that's worth, you know, $200 million. Great. But if we build this resort on this beach, we could make $500 million. So obviously, screw the coral reef. Let's just build the resort. So by trying to appeal to the capitalist power structure on their own values of money, what they're basically doing is essentially saying that everything in nature is for sale. As true pristine nature gets to be rarer and rarer, based on the whole sort of economics of supply and demand, it just makes makes it even more valuable to sell them off. So it just look, for example, at the wildlife in Africa that is being driven to extinction. And that's something that just drives me just crazy with like pain to see what's going on. And so again, when you look at this thing from this ecosystem services point of view, and you try to do things like say, well, you know, we should put a price on ivory, just allow some amount of hunting to be done so that we need to sort of manage it in that way. Of course, what happens is the fewer elephants there are, the more valuable the ivory is, so the more valuable it is to go and kill off the last elephant. So it's this kind of self-defeating approach. And that's where I think for those of us who recognize this, what's so important is to come from our core, to look at what is truly valuable in our lives. And when we get engaged, when we come look at what we're going to do to try to shift things, to really come from our sense of what's true intrinsic value is driving us, rather than try to sort of translate it into terms that this kind of monetized economy can relate to. And I do think that's where our hope arises, you know, quite frankly, Ayana, because the thing is, our intrinsic values are really good. And we care about community. We care about the earth. That's just part of being human. And to the extent that we can encourage people to appeal to what they know in their heart and soul is right, that's, I think, the most dangerous, subversive thing that can happen to this whole corporate system, is for people to actually feel into what's right and say, I'm not going to take this crap anymore because this doesn't feel right to me.
I so agree that if we were able to tap into our feeling sense, our emotion, our intuition, our instinct, our heart, you know, however we want to say it or whatever words we want to use to describe this connection, I think we would expand the way that we relate to the world. And it seems that perhaps another way that the dominant culture has disconnected itself from the interconnectedness of the biosphere is by focusing pretty much solely on the brain as the only organ of perception. And I think it's just so vital to remember that our hearts and gut are also sensory organs, home to the neural networks. And it reminds me of the Stephen Herod Buhner episode, and his teachings on plant intelligence have included how the heart is where one communicates with plants from. And when I interviewed him, he shared words of an indigenous elder who told him that you have to wake up twice in the morning. You have to wake up your mind, and then you also have to wake up your heart. Or feeling senses, just they've been silenced by the noise of brain logic. And this brings me to how you trace the patterning instinct back to the development of the prefrontal cortex region of the brain in humans. So I guess I'm wondering, is the patterning instinct exclusive to the brain's realm of perception? And if so, practices that sharpen and expand one's heart feeling senses, you know, practices that open one's door of perception, if you will, could perhaps de-pattern the patterning instinct?
Yes, I hear you on that. You know, it's so interesting. Really what happened is in the Western way of thinking, again, starting with the ancient Greeks, they took one aspect of this patterning instinct, our ability to come up with reasoning and sort of intellectual ability. And they looked at that as divinity. Basically, they looked at that mind-body split, and they said, that's the soul, that's the mind, and that's what's divine, and the rest of the whole body is like polluted, is this bad thing. But we see that so different in other cultures. And what I find so fascinating is, if you look at traditional Chinese culture, the word in Chinese for mind is actually heart. So the word is xin, which is literally translated as heart, but that's what actually the Chinese refer to as mind. So oftentimes people will just translate that as heart slash mind. So imagine if you had a culture which starts off with this notion that your mind is there, is beating in the center of your body, and how different that makes you understand everything. So, you know, when your emotions make your heart beat faster, that's your mind actually relating. So there is no split between mind and body in that whole way of thinking. And that's, and of course we see that all through indigenous cultures, just like you're referring to. And what gets me quite excited, oftentimes feel a sense of hope out there, is that we even see in modern scientific findings the same recognition of our connectedness. So in systems sciences, whether we can look at it in terms of complexity theory or systems biology, or, you know, these sciences that are very rigorous, analytical, the rest of it. But what they discover is the same thing, is that actually we are all connected. And actually there is no distinction between heart and mind. And in fact, just like you were talking about, our neural networks, the heart itself has its own neural intelligence. And in fact, what I call animate intelligence is there everywhere in nature, just like you're referring to in plant intelligence and in the intelligence of like trees. You know, you were talking with Peter just a few weeks ago, like how trees connect with each other in community through their roots. And throughout the universe of the natural world, we see this alternative intelligences, and we see everything connecting up. And what I find really exciting is this notion that through modern systems understanding of the science, we can recognize how ecosystems work, and we recognize that the true insight and wisdom of traditional wisdom is actually right there in our modern scientific understanding. We just need to surpass this kind of outmoded, reductionist way of looking at the world that has become dominant in our culture, but is no longer, really has no validity, no matter which way you look at it.
So once we begin to dissect our patterning, we can begin to shift how we make meaning and relationship to the world and with one another. So I'd love to hear real tangible ways in which we can embrace your findings.
Yes, I think a core part of it is to realize that that patterning instinct is not just something that creates our ability to reason and this mind-body split, but it also allows us to integrate the ways in which we pattern meaning with our embodied existence. So to give you a sense of just how that can apply in our own personal practices. So for example, maybe I would imagine a lot of listeners would have some kind of meditation practice. But even meditation practices can sometimes fall prey to this kind of mind-body split where you sort of feel, oh, I've got, you know, my mind is sort of connecting with my body. But that's still based on this kind of split. But, you know, some wonderful traditional Chinese practices like Qigong or Tai Chi, for example, are these kind of energy practices which allow us to really recognize our embodied existence. And you can actually develop meditation practices of really feeling ourselves, not just as a mind recognizing it has a body, but as a body being intelligent, a body and being part of our organism, of what essentially a mind-body organism. And through that kind of practice, we can look at our connections with the world, not just using our minds to connect, but really feeling ourselves connected. We can do that in dance when we're connecting with others in community. And we can do that in our deep, deep connections with the natural world. So it's those deeper embodied connections with ourselves, with others, with nature, that we can use as the source, the foundation for our engagement in the world and for our activities and for the things that we do to try to change things. Because when we're coming from that kind of place and somebody starts talking about, you know, nature as ecosystem services, we say, what the hell are you talking about? This is not the reality that I know.
No, it is not the reality that I know. It is not the reality that I feel, ecosystem services. I remember going into a few conferences this last year that were about carbon sequestration and the future of environmentalism and climate change. And I remember feeling so empty and sad and protective over these lands that were spoken about as if they weren't alive, as if they didn't have value in and of themselves, but they only had value based off the services that they provided for humans. And it was a really big challenge for me to be able to be in that space with openness and love for people that were feeling so dominant over the land, but also wanting to have an openness, because I don't think that we're necessarily going to get very far if we keep alienating each other, even from people that we don't necessarily agree with. So it was a really good lesson for me.
I think that's so true. And I think especially there are some people that maybe we're so far from in terms of their approach to life and their politics that we can, you know, you can expend too much energy just even trying to reach those people. But oftentimes the kind of people who talk about things like ecosystem services are people who do come from a core sense of caring and wanting to put some sort of brake on what's going on. But it's as if they've been co-opted, they've been sort of bewitched by the sense of what they can do to try to, you know, speak to that dominant power. And I think that what's so important is to reach to that deeper place and find that point, that compassionate point of shared caring for the earth, and then try to like bring those people with us to recognize that what is really, you know, if they really touch into their deepest values, that might lead them to actually look at different ways of relating to some of these things. And I feel that we so have to do that because, you know, what I don't think any of us can afford is to let this sense of the power of this kind of dominant mainstream culture lead us to despair. While there seems to be so many things moving in the wrong direction, we also need to take hope from this recognition that we're all embedded together in this thing. And a lot of the ways in which complex systems change happens in what I call, what's called like a non-linear way. And it's really quite amazing how things can change when we stay with our truest feelings and communicate that together with each other. And that's where I think we absolutely have to look at the devastation going on. We have to feel into the sense of despair. And I must confess, I feel that so much. It's hard for me sometimes to sort of pull myself out of it. But from that place, we have to recognize that, you know, as long as there's life, there's this possibility of redirection. And every one of us is engaged in this kind of web of life, this web of meaning, as I call it. And so the recognition of that destruction is so painful. There is this sense of hope I get that everything we do, like this kind of conversation we're having today, or the kind of conversations that we can have with each other in meaningful ways, that those can really make a difference even when we're not seeing it. So, you know, I love to think of the analogy of like the mycelial network, the fungal network of tree roots that are moving together, acting together, even when we don't see them. And similarly, even though the headlines we read about every day look so destructive and we see the bad things going on, but at the same time, there is millions of us connecting up, sharing these values, sharing this outrage. And that ultimately can have these, make this incredible impact in where our future can go, as long as we're ready to really live according to our true values, our true feelings.
Thank you for bringing up truth-telling and compassion and how we can share our deepest feelings and our deepest relational connections with one another, but in a way that the other can hear it and know that it's a challenging road when we've been separated from one another and from the earth for so long, and now we're at this apex moment of climate change and extinction and social destruction and political destruction, and to be able to come together in this really heightened moment and listen deeply and share when the time is right. It's the way forward, but it's not easy. So I thank you so much for bringing up that eloquent point. And you often use these examples of the early development of human language when describing the patterning instinct. And I wonder, when other life forms are learning language, is it not the patterning instinct that propels their learning? You know, for instance, when wolf pups learn to make meaning from the sounds of the ravens their pack has a mutualistic relationship with.
That's right. They see this even in organisms like slime molds that don't even have brains. And there's this really, really deep patterning or ability to recognize patterning in life itself, I think, that we see everywhere. And most definitely in social creatures, and like wolves is a perfect example, or we see that, you know, in whales, in dolphins, or you name it, in elephants. You see these amazing ability to connect using something like our patterning instinct. And in fact, I think that there's probably these deep intelligences that we humans can't even touch into, that that some of our other animals that we share, that we continue to share our the earth with at this point, have, that we don't have, that we maybe would never even be able to conceive of. And so I think that's a really key point. And the thing about the particular human patterning instinct is that it developed to this other layer where it developed what I call, or what other people also call, the sort of symbolic or conceptual consciousness, this ability to see the world in a symbolic way. And that's what led to things like the kind of human language that we have, and all the different ways in which humans see themselves as separate from nature, which is why I see the role of integration as being so important. Because while we humans have this kind of separateness from the rest of the natural world that I think other animals don't have, we also can use that ability to integrate that with our deep animate connectedness, that part of our reality that we share with the wolves, with the trees, with everything else around us. And I think focusing on integration, focuses on practices of integration, embodied practices, and understanding the world from this integrated kind of place, that is, I think, the path to regain really a place of human harmonization with the world rather than this destruction path that we're on right now.
Well, goodness, thank you so much, Jeremy, for taking us through decades and different eras and the mind and the heart and our current trajectory and how we may shift that moving forward. So I really appreciate the time with you and your work.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ayana. It's just been so great connecting and talking with you, and hopefully, yeah, these connections will just resonate out there in that web of life that we were talking about, to share with others and to really make a difference in this world.
Thank you for listening to For the Wild podcast. I'm Ayana Young. The music you heard today was Solaris, Every Piece. Our theme music is Silence Returns by Bo and Like a River from Kate Wolf. I'd like to thank our incredible team, our producer and editor, Andrew Storrs, research director, Madison Mogulski, and media director, Malia Lebov. If you haven't already, rate us on iTunes and head over to our website to sign up for our newsletter. All right, until next time.